Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the Order of the Temple of Astarte's unique method of astral time travel. We first conceived and developed this method back in the early 1970s. It was an outgrowth of our pathworking program. It has much in common with remote viewing in that a target area, and in our case, a time in the past, is selected and mapped, and then a celestial reference point and distance in light years is selected. This data is absorbed and studied. For example, if we want to visit ancient Alexandria, which is one of our favorite tours, we consult archaeological books with accurate graphic recreations to set the general environment at the time. We can use the overhead mirror or the soul door as our launch portal. We can use Kusor's boat if we are launching through the soul door. In either case, we will use a constellation rather than a tatua for a concentration point on the mirror. This is a second degree practice because previous pathworking experience is required for it to be effective. It is a deep trance activity and can produce significant results. The more precise, well documented, and prepared these operations are, the more impressive they will be. So, if you want to read lost books in the great library, you should at least know what ancient Greek looks like. So tune in and we'll take you on a very long journey. Now this is something that we discussed in our astral projection episode about 3 years ago, I think. We discussed it briefly, but this show we're going to get into more detail on the astral time travel system. Now, this is probably unique to us. I don't know anyone else who does this, but so as far as I know, we're the ones that developed this. Is the celestial method that we use using the magic mirrors, either the overhead mirror hanging down from the ceiling in which we get under and look up at, or the soul door, which is, as most of you know, a large portal looks the size of a doorway in the wall of the temple, surrounded, if you are able to do so, with an Egyptian-style arch, and a dark mirror. The whole door is a dark mirror. So you can use either one of these. The advantage, of course, in using the soul door is that you can use Kusor's boat, and I think we have discussed that in previous programs. And those of you who have our pathworking video, you know Kusor's boat is shown at the end of the video on the first basic pathworkings. Kusor's boat is about 14 inches long and it's shaped like an ibis. It has a cockpit, it has a compass, it has a couple of candle holders on the ports, so you can put candles on either on the port and starboard ports, and you can the candles, the color of the spheres, and also gives you a little bit of hypnotic quality there. You have a rudder on the boat, and if you're using the boat individually, you can put your own wax simulacrum in it, or if it, in a group, of course, then we put the boat on the top of the altar. It has its wings folded on either side. And the starboard side of the boat is all white, and the port side of the boat is all black. And the wings, of course, are the same color charge. So when the boat takes off from the top of the altar, it spreads its wings and flies through the soul door. And, of course, it then can go anywhere on the Tree of Life, or in this case, we can use it to fly out into the universe, carry us out. It then becomes a starboat. Now, that, as I say, is a good technique to use with a soul door, but then when you're forming a ground star underneath the overhead mirror and you're looking up, we have, where we put a tatwa on the mirror and you'd all stare up at it. Those of you who have our Rites of Magic video, and of course also the Pathwork video, you've seen this technique demonstrated. But that doesn't work out so well with the boat, so we have to go. But the mirror has its own advantages, so either system will work. Now, how this particular astral time travel system came about. Back in 1972, 73, we developed our pathworking system based upon Kirpal Singh's original Ekankar system, which, of course, we got ours directly from Kirpal Singh, not from Paul Twitchell, but we, of course, tabalized it. Kirpal Singh is a Sikh Satguru, so we tabalized his attention point technique. And I think most of you are listeners and, of course, associate members. You're familiar with that. But Kirpal Singh's pathworking system is, I think, generally recognized as the best. And it's fairly deep hypnotic trance is required. So what we got into at this point, we started doing these pathworkings, and time travel seemed to be a logical thing to the next step. It seemed to be something that we wanted to do. And so I got a little book, one of Weiser's Paths of Power, called Practical Time Travel by Colin Dadd. It's a little bitty thing. I don't think it's probably not available anymore. He had a hypnotic approach similar to what we were doing, but he was mainly concerned with previous incarnations. And when you're doing a group time travel and you have to pick a destination for a group, individual previous incarnation isn't going to work so well. So we started thinking about doing this sort of in a general kind of a way, so a group of people could experience it and enjoy it. We wouldn't have to depend on previous. We do previous incarnations, of course, in our path workings, as now, and also in our yoga. So we didn't need to do to follow Colin Bennett's ideas on past lives. But some of his suggestions were good in hypnosis. He had, I think this may have been what originally started off, he had an initial exercise in that book where you went out and lay down and looked up at the stars, and you realized how far the stars were away, and you gave yourself a feeling of the immensity of space and time. And as far as he was concerned, this was a preliminary to his other methods. This was just to give you an expanded sense of time. But I think it inspired me, and I thought, oh boy, looking out at those stars and how far are they away. And at that point, I thought, wait a minute. This is one of these ahas that hit. We're looking out at a star, and we're seeing that star. And that star is, let's say it's 500 light years away. Well, that means that the light that we are seeing, the light that we are actually seeing is 500 years ago. We're seeing that star 500 years ago. So, being already infused with magical thinking, I thought, well, if we're seeing that star 500 years ago, then if we were to go to that star, not with the speed of light, but with the speed of thought, which is instantaneous, if we were to go to that star, then we would be 500 years in the past, because that's what we're seeing. We're going to what we're seeing. Now, I know this is magical thinking. Well, this is really magic, but still, it has a certain elegance to it. So I thought, okay, so we're seeing the star 500 years ago. All right, let's go to the star. That gets us 500 years in the past. Then let's look back at Earth, or Sol, of course, and say, okay, now we're seeing that 500 years in the past. And so we'll go back to Earth and go back to the solar system and land on Earth, and my gosh, we're 1,000 years in the past. Oh, boy. So this kind of dawned on me. And as I say, Colin Bennett had his book, you just go out and lie and look up at the stars and realize, and I just did. I read that, and I thought, uh-huh. And then I came up with this idea of the light years behind. Now, so we figure out how to project to that star through a ritual hypnotic process, and we'll project out there, and then we'll come back, and we'll be 1,000 years in the past. Oh, boy. Automatic magical time machine. Now, I got to admit this now, and I know I'm going to get kidded about it, but then I really should admit it, that I think something that from my childhood that I had read and looked at and loved had something to do with this also. And that is that, and I don't think any of you, very few of you remember Captain Marvel. Probably hardly any of you do, because Superman sued Captain Marvel and put him out of business. Actually, that was kind of unfair, because Captain Marvel was more original than Superman, but Superman had the money. They had the big bucks, and so they put Captain Marvel out of business. But for a while, when I was growing up, Captain Marvel was really popular. Well, anyway, Captain Marvel, instead of being Clark Kent, where he was Superman all the time and just took off his business suit and went in the phone booth and took off his business suit and became Superman. Instead of that, Captain Marvel was more magical. Captain Marvel was a little crippled newsboy named Billy Batson. And Billy Batson because he was such a good little newsboy and he deserved it and all this, the great wizard, the immortal wizard Shazam, gave Billy Batson the magic word that he could say, and it would transform him into the superhero Captain Marvel. And that word, of course, was the same name as the wizard, Shazam. Well, Shazam, of course, stood for the strength of Atlas and the heroics of Hercules and the wisdom of Athena and all of the powers of the gods. Well, Shazam had a palace. All wizards should have a palace, And Shazam had a palace, but his palace was out in the middle of the universe, right in the center of the universe, on a pinnacle of rock that rose up, well, from the bottom of the panel on a page of the comic book. Of course, it rose up, and you couldn't see the bottom of it. But there it was out there in the stars, this pinnacle rock with this palace on the side of it. And this was the Rock of Eternity, where Shazam had his palace. Now, if Captain Marvel wanted to go anywhere in time, back in time, all he had to do was fly around the Rock of Eternity, because that was the center of the universe, you see. He could fly around it, And there were all these vectors, and these vectors were lined out, and they wrote down, of course, on the comic book page that was 10,000 years ago to Atlantis, and 5,000 years ago to Babylon, and 2,000 years ago to Cleopatra in Egypt, and all that kind of stuff. So all he had to do was just go circling around the Rock of Eternity, and he could go anywhere back in time. Well. Of course, I remembered that. I think I can close, I don't even need to close my eyes. I can see it on the wall. I can project that panel. I can see it perfectly. So that's how much of an impression it made on me. Oh, by the way, Mad Magazine did a satire of Captain Marvel, and they came up with a magic word. Instead of Shazam, it was Shazoom. And Shazoom meant strength, health, aptitude, ox power of one, ox power of another, money. That was Shazoom. But anyway, I think it wasn't Shazoom that killed Captain Marvel. It was Superman suing Captain Marvel. But then, not to leave Superman out, those of you who remember Superman's time travel method, he would circle the Earth at top speed. Of course, Superman's top speed was pretty top, as you know, it's over the top. He would circle the Earth against the sun, and he would go forward in time that way, or backward in time, whichever way he wanted to, by circling against the sun. So, not wanting to leave Superman out, even though he did unfairly vanquish Captain Marvel, we used that as a return method. Now, here's how we worked this thing out. Take the star, and in order to do this, and to do it right, you have to get a lot of astronomical data. You have to have a catalog of all the stars and how far away they are and whatever. And you should really what you ought to do, and this is especially easy now when we have the Hubble. You should get very good photographs of these stars that you're going to use. These points, so you can visualize them, so you know where you really know where you're going. Then, as far as the location, now there's really a bit of we're kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't in a situation like this, because if we give you a lot of data and pictures and graphics and maps and everything else, then we're filling you with preconceived stuff. So what, so you might ask the question, well, you guys, yeah, you're going to go, all right, you're going to go to Alexandria 2,000 years ago. All right, now that's fine. But if you go and show everybody a lot of pictures of Alexandria, then that's what they're going to see. And why not just tell them that's where they're going and don't tell them what they're going to see and then find out? Well, it's kind of a combination of the two. Now, here again, let me revert to my favorite analogy in this case, military versus civilian magic. Okay. Now, if the Army is going to do this, or the Air Force is going to do it, or NASA is going to do this, and gosh knows they might, because, you know, we've spent a lot of taxpayers' money doing stuff like this. If they wanted to do this, what they would do is they would give you nothing but absolutely factual stuff. In other words, yeah, sure, you get a photograph of the star, that's good, we can do that, that's factual. And then if it comes to an ancient location, it better be archaeologically correct right down to the, you know, closest we can get it. Now, that would actually satisfy military standards for something like this. And you may be thinking while I'm saying this, oh, come on, the military isn't going to go visit Alexandria 1,000 years ago and go out to some star and go around and commit. Yes, actually, they might. And here's the reason. We have discovered, and it's not wishful thinking or romantic, egotistical wishful thinking anymore. It is hard, cold fact that the human mind consciousness can project itself almost anywhere. And I say almost because I don't know how far we've been able to do it yet, but it doesn't seem to be any limit. And we've proved this, the Russians have proved this. And so it's for people who are not really steeped in Hermetic philosophy, this is kind of a scary thing. I mean, it really is. Because how can this possibly be? How can a human being sitting in a trance in a room with a map go and find out what's going on inside a room in a Siberian rocket station? Huh? But they can, and they do. Now, you tell me how. I know how. I know how. But almost nobody, including the government people that are actually doing this, can really give you a straight answer as to how they can do it. But Hermes Trismegistus 2,000 years ago told us exactly how we can do it. And basically, it's the old rock of eternity again. According to Hermes, and I'll read you a little section here. Hang on. This is one of my favorite, The Way of Hermes. That's that new book that is really the epitome, I think, of Hermetic teachings. According to The Way of Hermes, Hermes says, and I quote directly, "Consider this. Command your soul to go anywhere, and it will be there quicker than your command. Bid it to go to the ocean, and again it is there at once. Not as if it had gone from place to place, but was already there. Order it to fly up to heaven, and it will need no wings, nor will anything impede it, neither the fire of the sun, nor the aether, nor the whirlwind, nor any other heavenly bodies, but cutting through them all, it will soar up to the last body, and if you wish to break through all this and contemplate what is beyond, if there is anything beyond the cosmos, it is in your power." And that was written almost 2,000 years ago. The Rock of Eternity in Captain Marvel isn't quite so silly when you think about it, because the idea here is that everybody has God inside them, and everybody has an equal part of God, and you can't quantify or qualify God. If you've got part of God, you've got all of God, if you make use of it. You are the center of the universe. The universe has no boundary, and you're the center of it. So this means that wherever you want the center to be, that's where your center is going to be, wherever you want to send it. And this is what makes this work. I know it makes it work, and yes, it does, and we know that and all that. But then on the other hand, how much are we, especially in romantic magical practice, how much are we loading in advance? How much are we? How much of this is a power of suggestion that we're implanting to start with? How much of this is what we want, not exactly what we want? It's not what we need, it's what we want. How much of this? Well, the government, you know, when they do it, they are very concerned with what they call analytical overlays. Now, that's what they mean by that is that when they will lay out for a remote viewer, they'll lay out map coordinates, and they'll lay out, and they may even give him aerial photographs, satellite photographs, whatever, that which they know is actually there, and you know, they're sure it's there. And then they'll send him off, and they want to know just exactly what his first impressions are and nothing else. They don't want him to try to analyze what he's seeing. They want a report about, okay, what'd you see, what you hear, that's it. And don't try to interpret it. That's up to them. I have, in all my years of magic, I've discovered the same thing. I've worked with some psychics, magicians that were just marvelously psychic. But I ended up having to interpret their visions, because their interpretation of their vision didn't seem to be what a... I could tell that they were exaggerating and that they were picking stuff, preconceived stuff out. You can tell. And so you have to interpret first off. Now, so those are the limitations. If we were doing this from you know, from an intelligence standpoint. But we're not. We're doing this for personal development. We're doing this for within a romantic tradition. So therefore, we don't have, but we should be aware of all of this, because what this technique that we're doing, and I want to make this very clear, this technique that we're doing is not just a, this isn't just an entertainment. This we have actually, I think we've learned a few things in ancient Alexandria. I'm not going to say what they are, but I've had some surprises, and I've led the, usually the person who leads either the pathworking or the time travel group is not going to be in as deep a trance as those who are going with him. But even so, I've picked up a few things that I didn't expect to find. And there are, so this is a very powerful technique and a very useful technique. And quite frankly, very, very enjoyable and inspiring technique. But the main purpose of it is not so much to find out, to translate the lost books of Manetho in the library at Alexandria. I can't even remember where shelf they're on, to tell you the truth. But I wish I could, because those books are, boy, oh boy. But then again, if we publish those things today, they would cause a probably, the Gaza Strip would get completely wiped out. It wouldn't just get translated. But anyway, the point of this is that try to make sure, if you really want real information, try to make sure that you don't load up preconceived instructions, any preconceived graphics or anything that are not archaeologically sound. So what do we want to do when we do Solomon's Temple? Oh, my gosh. Well, we do Solomon's Temple, of course. Well, there we have to. Now, here's another side, this thing. There, when we do Solomon's Temple, we have to get mythological. We have to, because Solomon's Temple, in the way we conceive it, is pretty much a myth, both a Masonic myth and a biblical myth. Solomon's Temple, I think there was a Solomon's Temple. I know Karim Kusa thinks that there was, and he thinks it was just them talking about the temple of Melkart at Tyre, but which of course it was obviously the model for it. But no, I think there was a temple of Solomon. But what it probably was something very much like the Kaaba. It's just, you know, a big square mud brick building, and inside they would have all of the little tribal gods would have their niche and have their gods in their niche, and each one of them would have a day or a time when they could come in there and take their god out, put it in the center of the temple, and do their thing. So probably the Levites and tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Judah, which were all the original Jews anyway, they probably had their the Ark, which was an Egyptian box that they had, and they probably had this Ark, and they probably had it in their own niche. And on Saturdays, they got to come in and put it in the center of the temple, and so when Ezra was writing the Bible in captivity, he romanced this into being Solomon's Temple. Now that's the hard, cruel reality of it. All right. Well, I'm not going to bother. You know, I'm not going to try to get people back to something like that, because we have created a very usable, a very, very usable and a very worthwhile myth of Solomon's Temple. We've gone into great detail to do it. So it lives in mythological time, and there's more that we can find out about it in the mythological time that it exists. So when we take a time travel to Solomon's Temple, we're going to go to Solomon's Temple as it is described in the Bible, because that's the mythological description of it. Now, you may say that's wrong, but at least we will know, at least our time travelers, they know that they're going to myth time. They're visiting the myth time. One of the things that makes this kind of easy to rationalize if you want to, it's the simultaneous concept. You know, I think there's a dimension. Let's put it this way. There's a dimension where Solomon's temple is just exactly as it's described in the Bible. And there's a dimension where King Arthur lives in Camelot, and it's just the way it's described in Mallory. Somewhere in the simultane, in all of the slices of the simultane, these parallel worlds exist. And if they don't, they should. But we should still be aware of, you know, what we know from archaeology. No, we need to be sophisticated. Take a tantric Buddhist attitude toward all of this, and you'll have no problem with it whatsoever. Okay? Anyway, to get back to the technical aspects of this thing, so let's say we're going to want to go out to Alexandria. We picked Betelgeuse in Orion. By the way, Orion has a lot of interesting stars, including, I have a personal star out there too. But that's another aspect about this that it should fascinate all of you, is that each one of you, everybody has their own star. Yeah. And if you got your own star, your star in the ascendant, if you do, we all do, wouldn't it be nice to be able to visit it? And your star, if it's any good at all, it probably has a nice planet around it. And you know, you could... And who knows, maybe you had a previous incarnation. There is all kinds of stuff. But visiting your own star, whether you want to romance your star or not, if you're a scientific frame of mind, my star is a red dwarf, and I'm all right. Yeah, well, go there and see how the red dwarfs live. But, that brings us to the next essential part of this. As we have mentioned over and over and over again, astrology is the bedrock of Hermetic science and magic. It is the bedrock of Hermetic science and magic. Now, why is it and why is that the case? Yeah, sure, if you're a chaos magician, you throw astrology out. But we're not chaos magicians. We're cosmos magicians, okay? So the reason why astrology is important to us, even if it had only been invented a couple hundred years ago instead of 22,000 years ago, even if it had, we would still need it, because the magician is the center of his universe, and astrology is geocentric. And whether or not Copernicus is fine, and we have no problem with Copernicus, but astrology is geocentric because the universe, from your perspective, is uocentric, is humanocentric, and this is why the geocentric astrology system works so well with magic. And as I said once, and I will say again many times, if you are going to be the ruler of your universe, then you need a universe to be the ruler of. And if you say, okay, well, I'm going to go out and be the ruler of the universe the way it is, well, too bad, because the universe the way it is so vast, so complex, and so far beyond your understanding that I'm afraid it's going to take you at least 10 incarnations before you can even approach it. So it's much better to have a mythological universe, which we know works. I said it's 22,000 years old. Well, that's what I think. But we know damn well, and for an absolute fact, that it started Bullseye, Taurus, and the Pleiades back 4,200 years ago when Taurus was right on the ecliptic at spring equinox, okay? Now, I think it actually was a previous age of Taurus, but that's my opinion, but whatever. However, that's when it started. And data has been collected meticulously ever since. So the labors of Hercules and that we all have to do over these incarnations are very, very well worked out in the heavens and on earth as far as the data is concerned. Ptolemy gathered up all of that had been collected for thousands of years in Babylon, and he codified it all under the aegis of Alexander, and then so the Common Era, the beginning of the Common Era, or a couple hundred years before the beginning of the Common Era, we had what is now what we now call astrology, what we now consider astrology. But it has statistical data that goes back 3,000 years before that. And that's why, even though this is a mythological universe, which you can grasp, you can learn this, you can handle it, and it works. So this is your universe. Huh? Yeah. So that's why this time travel system is also hooked to astrology. It's hooked to this magical universe, but it needs to be, in order to be effective, it needs to be precise. And the more precise you make it, the more effective it is. Now, we started off in 73, I think, doing the stellar analog astrological time travel, or astro time travel. And ever since then, we've been working toward making the mythological and astrological universe more and astronomical universe too, more accessible, almost from an engineering point of view. And we finally, after all we finally managed to accomplish what Dee and Kelly tried to do and couldn't do, and we did this well, I've been working on it for God knows how long, but I mean, finally, I got Dr. Krupp down at the observatory to give me some computer hints on how to get it together. And we did it, and it's in the green ray. So if you really want to find out the engine that makes, that puts the fine touches on this, the system of calibration, shall we say, the way to line up the vectors. You know, remember Captain Marvel flying around the rack of eternity with those vectors going off in different directions? And it's 10,000 years to 10,000 years to Atlantis and 2,000 years to Cleopatra. All right, now, if you want to really be able to run those vectors and really have a handle on this, then you need our Summa Sophia system. And that is in the seventh ray, number 3, the green ray, and that is available on Amazon for, I guess, about $19 or something like that. It's worth it. So those of you who aren't associate members, of course, associate members, you get a grand prize. But that's plug. But if you are really, really want to dig into this, then I suggest that you get that green ray and read that Summa Sophia article and just imagine as you're reading that article what kind of an engine this really is. This is an awesome concept. We can actually literally we keep reducing down basically it's a version of the Deccans divided into nine chambers. We continue, which if you're thinking the Kabbalah of nine chambers, you're right, because it's part of it. And you keep reducing on a vector. And we can literally put a Greek letter on a planet going around a star 500 light years away. And we can do it with absolute precision. Now that has... So the more, as you can tell, the more precise you do, because the mind, the human mind, it not only is a vast computer, or it's hooked to the brain, which is a vast computer, it runs the brain, the mind is the software for the brain, as we say, that is also connected to a network that makes it a supercomputer. And the more precise you make this targeting for our astral, celestial, remote viewing, the more accurate you make it, the more accurate it will be. And it's up to you to decide how much mythological exploring are you going to do and how much real, or what we call real. In other words, in whatever direct line in this particular simultane that you're going to try to do, then you need to make those decisions, but those are your decisions to make. I think the mythological explorations, if you understand the nature of mythology, I think mythological explorations are in their own way just as important. Magically, they certainly are. And the effect of this, you know, if you're wondering, well, what's this good for? Well, for one thing, this is good for expanding and extending your consciousness. Expanding and extending your consciousness, giving you it moves you closer to what we call God, because you know, God is so awesome that the bigger you get and the more you extend yourself, the more awesome you realize God is, the more the vaster His creation is. And that in itself is part of the process of enlightenment. And to, on the one hand, share in the power of God, share in the knowledge of God, and on the other, as you do so, you realize how little actually that how much more you have to learn, and how much more there is to learn, and how much more there is to experience. And that is the idea of celestial magic is, yes, certainly to know what's in store for you so you can work positively with it, turn the crank the way it goes astrologically, and use your own horoscope as a map to determine where you are in this particular incarnation, and also where you're going to be in the next one, and you get an idea of what kind of progress you're making this time. And I think that the whole celestial magic process is probably the closest we're going to be able to come, the closest experience we can have to being godlike, and to being to get away from this feeling of a small, minuscule existence on a small planet out in the corner of the galaxy. I think that this system and this approach will fulfill in many ways the promise of hermetic magic that we come from the stars, and to the stars we will return. And I encourage you to look into it more, and we're going to, of course, have a more detailed publication on what we've covered tonight. But that, remember that what you need to do this is you need astronomical data. You need to be very familiar with astrology. You need to have a good idea of where it is you're going to go. And then you should, if you're going to do the archaeological idea, then get your best archaeological stuff. I have a book on ancient Alexandria, a great big coffee table book, which has reconstructions of what the city looked like. It even has an aerial view of the ancient city, so we can fly on in. And of course, that lighthouse is Pharos Lighthouse. That's the landmark as you come on into the city, and naturally, of course, you're going to want to visit the Serapeum, and you're going to want to visit the library, and we even one time when we were there, they were even having a riot, and the Christian monks were and their followers were rioting, and they had a cordon of Roman soldiers holding them back, So you will see some interesting things, and certainly this is a consciousness expanding experience. I was expecting Frater Solomon to call in, but he never did. Anyway, that's about all I have for tonight, and I will be back next week with another show on another interesting subject, and hopefully we'll bring on a guest. But certainly, meanwhile, I encourage you, based upon what we've been discussing tonight, I encourage you to get a hold of the Seventh Ray, the Green Ray, book number 3. You get it from Amazon and read and study the Summa Sophia article. And meanwhile, good magic, and we'll see you next week.